Welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 128 for January 20th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
By the time he was 18, he had quite an expansive knowledge of English literature, Latin, Greek, French, and mathematics, which a lot of people in that time in his station in life didn't have access to.
That's Joanne Gilmartin, who performs and teaches the works of the one and only Robert Burns, along with leading tours of Scotland. It's time for the annual Whiskey Cask tribute to Robert Burns. But first, let's look at the news. Of course, Burns was a reluctant exciseman, but his modern-day successors are far less so. In fact, the Express and Star reports that Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs has knocked down an illegal distillery in Wensbury. A father and son, ages 65 and 23, were arrested after officers found four illegal stills and cases of something called Highland Piper. Whatever it sure wasn't something one would want to drink. The officers say the bootleggers were using animal feed in their stills instead of grain. The names of the bootleggers have not been released. Of course, the stuff those two were making would never have gotten within a sniff of a royal warrant, but the famous Grouse carries one. Edrington Group's flagship blend has had its royal warrant renewed for another 5 years as an official supplier to Britain's royal family. The Grouse has held a royal warrant since 1984. Lafroig also holds a royal warrant. In fact, it's known to be one of Prince Charles's favorite single malts. Last October at Whiskey Fest, I sat down for a few minutes with distillery manager John Campbell, and he had a couple of hints about new things to watch for.
We've got a few more kind of things up our sleeve that you might see in duty-free kind of towards maybe the end of this year, beginning of next year, but don't want to say too much yet because it's not a done deal, as you guys would say.
Now there's word that what John was hinting about is heading for duty-free. It's a 21-year-old Lafroig bottling that will only be available initially at the duty-free shops in Heathrow Airport's new Terminal 5 when it opens this spring, assuming it opens on time. Beam Global says the 21-year-old will also be sold in one or two other markets, but there's no word on which ones. By the way, Lafroig has its own site devoted to celebrating Burns Night. There's a link at the Whiskey Cask website. Al Capone, the legendary mob boss in Chicago during Prohibition, was responsible for coining the line, vote early and vote often. Now, while Capone's tactics swayed more than a few elections back then, voting early and often now can get one in trouble. Case in point, this week Diageo apologized after one of its U.S.-based brand managers went a little overboard in trying to win a Drammy Award for Johnnie Walker. The Drammies are the creation of Scotch blog editor Kevin Erskine. His readers nominate whiskeys in several categories, along with things like the Best Visitor Center. Then the voting begins. But Kevin tells us he spotted something unusual when the ballots started coming in.
Almost immediately, the day that the story went live, votes started to roll in. And the first thing was that they were all, well, not all of them, I shouldn't say that. They were split up between... I don't want to get too geeky, but the domain Diageo.com and Colangio-SM.com, I think. And so when I saw all of these votes rolling in from Colangio, I went to the site and saw that they were a marketing/advertising firm, and one of their clients was Diageo. And they were all in the same format. You know, it was, so they all had similar, Johnnie Walker. It was the Johnnie Walker Experience. And all of the other choices, and they did vote for the other categories where Diageo brands weren't mentioned, but they were all the same. And they all came into nominees at the Drammies, which is the email address that I had set up for nominations, but not the email address I had set up for votes. So those three things sort of kicked me off.
And when you contacted Diageo, what was the response?
Well, you know, obviously Diageo is a very large company, and I didn't contact anybody in a managerial position, but I did send a couple of things to some of the people that I know pretty well at Diageo, and it wasn't a "oh boy, that's a terrible thing" kind of response. So I just sort of let it go, and I wrote the story that appeared, I think, 2 days after the voting opened, which was voting in propriety. And that seems to what sort of got picked up by everyone. And, you know, I want to point out that in that story that I wrote, I never mentioned it was Diageo. I just said a large producer of alcohol did this, and I wasn't too happy about it, and I was going to disregard all of those votes.
And eventually they came clean, right?
Well, what had happened is that, you know, that's it. I mean, who reads my site, right? But eventually somebody from a press agency in Scotland called me up and said that he had read that and wanted to do a story on it. And I said, well, it's not really that big of a deal, but sure. And then apparently got picked up by all the major newspapers in the UK.
Diageo has since apologized, right?
They have apologized. And you know, and I wanted to make it clear that I never thought that this was some sort of evil empire Diageo thing. It is exactly what it is. It was, as Diageo said, one over exuberant brand manager who probably sent an email out to, you know, friends, the people he works with at Calandro, and said, vote for this. You know, the only thing wrong with that is that I think I've always been very clear that the Grammys are sort of a people's choice awards. I don't allow companies to nominate themselves, and I don't allow them to vote for themselves. One of the other things I do is I disregard votes that come in that are only voting for a single category. And I've gotten a bunch of those. And it's not an underhanded thing. It's people who, you know, are part of a community or really like a single product, or maybe somebody sends out an email. But if I don't have somebody who has voted in a good portion of the categories, then I disregard the vote. And, you know, I'm trying to do that because I want to make sure that, A, these are really people who read my site, and they're really people who enjoy whiskey.
When will the actual awards be announced?
Well, I have voting open through the end of the month. I've been keeping a tally going forward, but I'm not going to pre-announce anything. You know, it swings from day to day how many votes come in for one or the other. I'll keep reminding people on the site that the voting is open until the 31st. At that point, I'll disregard any other votes that come in. And pretty soon after that, I'll announce the winners.
You'll find Kevin's blog at thescotchblog.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The Brandy Library in New York City starts off its 2008 Spirit School classes this week with an Introduction to Scotch class on Tuesday the 22nd. There's also a class on American whiskeys and bourbon February 5th. The Victoria Whiskey Festival is this coming weekend in Victoria, British Columbia. Whiskey Live Tokyo is February 10th, followed by the first Whiskey Live in Auckland, New Zealand on the 16th. That same day, Woodford Reserve holds a Bourbon Academy class at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky, and the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society will hold a tasting of Campbelltown whiskeys at the Vaults in Leith on the 18th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at Laphroaig.com. That's Joanne Gilmartin singing one of Robert Burns' classic songs about whiskey, Oh Willie, Brewed a Peck of Malt. Every January 25th, Burns lovers around the world raise their glasses to toast Burns' birthday. This year marks the 249th anniversary of his birth, and Scotland is already planning an entire year of events in 2009 to celebrate the 250th anniversary. Joanne Gilmartin lives in California now. She'll be performing at a Burns supper in Reno, Nevada this year on Burns Night, but she grew up in Glasgow in a family that revered Robert Burns.
I was really lucky because my granddad and my mother, in fact, my whole family were interested in the works of Burns, and my granddad spoke the old Scottish tongue, which a lot of Burns's poetry is written in. So I was introduced to it at home when I was really young. And I entered my first Burns competition when I was 5 years old in Glasgow and was actually fortunate enough to win that competition and went on to compete in the school's competitions right up until I left school at 17. So that was my introduction to it.
And you actually run these competitions now, right?
I do, yes. The body who organised the school's competitions, and they still do that back home in Scotland just now, which is a great thing because not all kids are as fortunate as me to have a family that did like Burns, and I would have been exposed to it anyway. But a lot of children, their parents aren't so interested in it, so it gives them an introduction to it. And they still run the competitions, and they very kindly agreed to allow me to run competitions for school children over in America so that they can also be introduced to the works of Robert Burns at an early age as well.
What is the fascination that Scotland still has with Robert Burns more than 200 years after his passing?
I think one of the things that appeals to Scots, there's certain levels. He knew how to enjoy himself. He enjoyed a good drink with his friends, and he was very popular with the ladies as well. So, but that aside, I think that one of the things that really attracts Scottish people to Burns is that he was very patriotic, and he had a great dislike for any kind of injustice or hypocrisy that he saw in his lifetime. And bear in mind that stemmed from personal experiences, because it wasn't that long ago that the Jacobite rebellions and all that stuff had taken place, and Scots were forbidden to speak in their own language and to wear tartan and stuff like that. So he had, that was happening in his lifetime, and it was very real for him. And I think Scots can still today identify with that. The whole idea of man being equal regardless of how much money you have or what your station in life is, those things are still very real to not just the people in Scotland, but people all over the world. And I think that's why Burns appeals to people in different countries much more so than, say, Shakespeare or Goethe or any of the other poets or writers. They're not celebrated in the same way as Burns is nationwide and internationally.
I think it's because we can see many of the qualities that Burns had in us almost, as where you wouldn't see them necessarily in a Shakespeare or a Goethe, but you can see a bit of the rogue in Burns. You can see a bit of the person you'd see down at the corner pub in many ways.
Absolutely, yes. I think he was very much a people's person, and that comes across to people in all walks of life. And the fact that he was so ordinary and managed to go on and achieve the greatness that he has achieved today, I think that's an inspiration to people as well.
One of the questions I've had for a couple of years now is, how did he start writing poetry? How did he get involved in poetry and song? Because one would not think that that would be something that would have struck him back in that time period.
You're right when you say that, because he was, remember, he was born into a very poor household, and that wasn't uppermost in poor Scots households at that time. It was more in the lines of putting food on the table and making sure your children had clothes. So in that respect, it was quite unusual. He was working on his family farm from the age of 13. He was doing the equivalent of a man's job when he was only 13 years old. But by the time he was 18, he had quite an expansive knowledge of English literature, Latin, Greek, French, and mathematics, which a lot of people in that time in his station in life didn't have access to. It was largely due to his father. He encouraged him to become educated. But his mother encouraged him to foster a love of traditional Scottish ballads. She was very keen on the old Scottish tunes. And he actually, that's where his writing started from. While he was working out in the farm, he was observing nature. I'm sure you're familiar with the poem Tae a Mhuis. All of those things happened to him when he was very young and very impressionable. And I think that was where it kind of stemmed from. He had this gift, and with the combination of the education that came from his mother and his father, and the surroundings that he had, it just kind of sparked into the genius that we have today.
Was he essentially self-taught, or did his parents do most of the education when he wasn't working?
He got a lot of his education from, I suppose the best way to describe it would be like a private tutor, although it wasn't nearly as grand as that. They were very poor people. They actually lived, you can still see Burns' cottage to this day, and it's really quite astonishing because it was basically one room that the family lived in, and the other room in the house was shared with the family animals. The cows and the sheep and the pigs, etc., were all housed in the one building. And because they were poor and because they were trying to make ends meet, they took in lodgers. I'm not sure if that's a term that's used out with Scotland, but it basically means to take in a roommate, to have someone that comes in and shares your accommodation and shares the cost of running the accommodation. And one of the lodgers that they took into the Burns' house was a teacher, and he did private lessons with Burns. And obviously the young Burns was like a sponge. He was soaking up all this knowledge that he was able to get from his parents and this tutor that was living in his own house at the time.
And you mentioned the Burns Cottage. It still exists. In fact, you lead tours in the region, correct?
Yes, I do. I take tour parties. A lot of people from America, some people from other countries as well, have joined the tour parties. And that's always really a highlight of the tour, because I think until you've actually walked in the rooms that he's been in and seen the bed that he was actually born in, which is still there, and then you can go just across the street to the museum and see some of his original manuscripts written with his quill pen. And the museum has lots of artifacts and pieces from his life, his pistol when he was working as a tax collector, for example. So I think that really kind of brings it home to people when they can actually be where he was. They get a better sense of it. And then in the evening, we always have a Burns supper at the hotel, a traditional Burns supper. It doesn't matter what month of the year it is, we have it anyway. And for some people on the tour, that's their first introduction to Burns. Some of them are quite knowledgeable on it already, but a lot of them aren't. And the ones that haven't been have all said that that's been the highlight of the tour for them, to experience something like that, because there's nowhere else you're going to be able to do that.
What is the key to having a good Burns supper, other than plenty of scotch?
To be perfectly honest, you don't want to have a boring speaker, because... I think it's really important that you can strike a balance. Burns suppers in Scotland range from being really, really traditional to the point that women aren't even allowed in them. And I myself have been at Burns suppers in Scotland where I've been the singer and I've had to eat in a separate room and then come in and sing and then leave again. But it ranges from that right up to over here in California. I basically do a one-woman Burns show. It started off, they hired me to come and sing some Burns songs, and when they realized that I knew a bit about Burns, I ended up doing the whole thing. I MC it, I do their Immortal Memory, their toast, their Address to the Haggis, and then sing as well. And I think it's important that your speaker is interesting. Because unless you have a bunch of Burns scholars there, you don't want to bore them with facts and figures that really don't mean that much to them. So I think your speaker is a very important aspect, and also your haggis as well. You want to make sure you have a good haggis there.
And what is the key to making a good haggis?
Oh, that's a trick question. I think you need to get up really early in the morning to make sure that you're up before the haggis so that you can hunt them. No, seriously, I've never made a haggis. I do cook and I make quite a lot of traditional Scottish dishes, but haggis is something I haven't attempted. I think
it's probably one of those things that's easier to send out for, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of the butchers actually make them in Scotland, and you just go out and buy one. I think because it's really time-consuming and messy to make, to be perfectly honest, that it's not something that most people would want to attempt in their own kitchen.
What is your favorite work of Robert Burns?
I think probably one of his love songs, My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose, is definitely one of my all-time favourites. And with regards to his poetry, Tam O'Shanter is definitely my favourite. I know it's long and it's pretty difficult if you're not familiar with the language. But I would definitely encourage people to stick with it and to, you know, use a translation book for the words they're not familiar with, because it's an amazing story and it's really quite incredible that he wrote it really quickly, like in a couple of days or something. He wrote this entire epic. But of course it has a moral in the story, as much of Burns' work did have.
Now, one of the quotes that I think anybody that knows a little bit about Burns can quote, "Whiskey and freedom gang together." What's the context behind that?
I believe Burns, as I mentioned earlier, was very much a patriot of Scotland. And I think it is kind of paralleled with the Declaration of Arbroath, which was written in 1320. It's not for glory, riches, or honours that we fight, but for freedom, for that alone, which no honest man gives up, but with life itself. Burns was very much into that philosophy, and I think the poem For All That and All That that he wrote, The Rank Is But the Guinea Stamp, The Man's the Gowd For All That, kind of links in with that whole way of thinking, that Burns was very much for the common man, and it didn't matter if you were a prince or a knight, because above everything to him was honesty and doing the right thing, regardless of the cost. But at the same time, he knew how to enjoy himself. He enjoyed a whiskey in the local pub with his friends, and that's in fact where the Tam O'Shanter poem starts off, is in the public house. So I think the two of them kind of intertwined for Burns and for a lot of people today as well.
And you can't talk about Robert Burns without talking about his history as a gauger or an excise man. And for all intents and purposes, he wasn't a very good one at times, was he?
Well, he probably had a bit of a conflict of interest, because remember, he was collecting taxes for the whiskey that he enjoyed to drink. So there was probably a wee bit of a conflict of interest there. And I always say, when I'm singing the song, The Deal's a Wall with the Excise Man, to audiences that are unfamiliar with it, I explain it to them in such a way that he wrote this fantasy poem about the devil coming into the town, playing a fiddle, and taking all the tax collectors with him. And that then left the people in the town free to sing and dance and party and enjoy their now tax-free whiskey. So I think that would have been part of it. And it wasn't a job that he would have chosen as his first choice, but the farming was tough. Scotland was a harsh country to be farming in those days, and he had a growing family to support. So again, I think that speaks volumes of Burns' character, that he was willing to take a job that he knew would make him unpopular, and he knew he wasn't going to enjoy that much doing. But he took his responsibilities seriously, and he knew he had children to support, and he did what needed to be done in order to make that happen.
We talked earlier about your working with kids now and learning about Burns. Do kids today really understand poetry and writing that's in, for essentially, a different language that isn't spoken much today? From a poet that's been gone for more than 200 years, do kids get Robert Burns?
I think the best way I can answer that is by illustrating it with something that actually did happen to me in Los Angeles. I was in this school, and the children ranged from, I was in three classes, and they ranged from 5-year-olds up to 7-year-olds. And, of course, for each class, I tailored it slightly differently. But the thing that amazed me more than anything, I chose really simple short poems. In fact, for the 5-year-olds, I did the one that I had won my first competition with. And then I also did To a Mouse as well with them. And I tried to make the parallel to them that this gentleman lived a long, long time ago. I took pictures of Abraham Lincoln and stuff that, you know, they might identify with. I took Scotland's flag with me because most American children have the flag in their classroom and do the Pledge of Allegiance and everything in the morning. So I tried to make it so that they could identify with it. And I took a kilt with me and passed it round and let them feel how heavy it was, etc., etc. Then I told them about this little boy who had grown up in a farm and he was very poor and, you know, just kind of took it to their level so that they could identify with it and explained to them that it was written in a language that most people don't speak nowadays, and certainly people in America don't speak it. But in some ways that fit in quite well because the classes were made up of real multicultures. There was Asian children, Mexican children, Hispanic children, African-American children, and it really was quite something to see them all recite this poem at the end. I mean, it was only a four-line first verse of a poem, but they were really getting into it. And it was just so weird for me to see all these children of different backgrounds, different ethnic cultures, all reciting Burns's poem.
You never mentioned, what was the poem you read as a five-year-old that won you that competition?
Oh, Why the Juice.
You still remember it?
Oh, I do, yes. So why the juice should I recline and be an elf or boater? I'm 23 and 5'9". I'll go and be a soldier. That's the first verse of it.
We know about the Burns poetry, but we don't really know as much about his songs today. And you've performed some of those songs, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a really important part of Burns's legacy that he left to the world. Because had he not done what he did, we probably would have lost a lot of these old traditional melodies. We were talking earlier about Burns's mother having a love for the old Scottish ballads and passing that love on to her son Robert. Not only did he write his own songs, but he was also responsible for collecting a lot of the old traditional songs and putting his own words to them, to the old melodies. And in doing that, he kept those melodies alive, because otherwise we would probably have lost them. And he, particularly fiddle tunes, he was very fond of fiddle tunes and used them quite a lot. That's one of the reasons that Burns's songs are sometimes thought to be difficult to sing, because a lot of the melodies were originally written for a fiddle. But he definitely did us all a great service by doing that, because otherwise we may have lost a lot of those beautiful old tunes that we take for granted now.
You can find out more about Joanne Gilmartin's music and tours online at glasgowgirl.com, and there's a link at the WhiskeyCast website. Finally, I received an email this week from Devin Zell, who runs bourbondrinker.com. If you're a bourbon fan, it's a great site to check out. Anyway, Devin emailed me to announce a special event, the birth of his son Henry on the 15th. And he's already put away a special present for Henry's 21st birthday in 2029, a bottle of 2005 George T. Stagg bourbon. Devin picked that one because it's the same one that got him started down the whiskey path, and he wondered in his email whether other people have done the same. Well, I've received several emails over the past year or so from fathers who've wanted to put away some whiskey from their child's birth year, and as long as it's stored in a dark place and kept upright, it should hold up just fine, as long as Dad can resist the urge to leave it alone for 21 years. Me? I don't have that discipline. Congratulations, Devin, and enjoy these years. They pass by all too fast. That's all for this episode of Whiskey Cast. You can find links, the calendar of events, the Whiskey Cast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the Whiskey Cast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.